Welcome, gentle listener, to Still Dreaming, a podcast about existentialism and forever night. Welcome, gentle listener, back to Still Dreaming. Tonight's episode is number 13 of Season 1, and it's entitled Father Figure. It was directed by Gary Farmer and written by Michael Sadowski. It originally aired on October 13, 1992, and the synopsis, plundered from Wikipedia, tells us this. Nick protects a young witness to a mob hit, causing him to remember when he cared for an orphan with his vampire family in England during World War II. So, before I watch the episode, I wanted to record a few comments. Just after reading the synopsis, my fear is that the flashback storyline and the main storyline will just be exactly the same thing in different time periods, and the whole thing will be redundant as hell. Now, if in the flashback, Lacroix is there, and he terrorizes the young child by threatening to eat him, well, I mean, that could be fun. I'm always hopeful for a glimpse into a less compassionate Nick that provides contrast and suggests a centuries-long evolution of his character. But I'm guessing we won't get that in this flashback storyline. The World War II setting makes this only 50 years before the main storyline. So I assume Nick is more or less the broody seeker of humanity we know him as. The synopsis is boring, and it really gives me nothing to look forward to. So the most I'm hoping for is some character development for Nick, and maybe some nice moments of parenting with him and Natalie taking care of the witness. So these are my thoughts before I watch the episode. Let me give it a watch, and let's dive into the opening. We see a young girl who is literally skipping down the street, playing, and dressed like a toned-down punky Brewster. Gloves with no fingers, purple stockings, high-top shoes. Yeah, she's a dime store punky. She steals some comic books and runs off. The newsstand owner yells after the girl, but doesn't chase her. The girl takes off down the street and runs into an alleyway and right smack into an older man in a suit and knocks him over. He drops his suitcase and the girl runs off as the man scrambles to pick up his papers. Just then, two guys in a car on the street jump out and approach the man. And we know what's happening because we read the synopsis. The man is gunned down and the girl sees the murderer hiding behind some trash cans. The killers know a kid has seen them, but they don't hang around to chase her. They take off. That takes us to the opening credits. Back from the credits, the caddy pulls up at the crime scene. A different detective meets Nick there. His name is Dell. Dell explains that Skanky is at his daughter's choral concert. Huh. Okay. I wonder if John Capolos wasn't available to shoot for some reason. Anyway, Dell fills Nick in. It's a mob hit. The dead guy was known as Marty Spreadsheets. Okay. He's an accountant with known mob contacts. Natalie is there and she's examining Marty. She announces it was a professional hit. Two in the chest, one in the head, large caliber. Adele says there were no witnesses, but Nick detects a heartbeat nearby and goes off to look into it. And our girl comes out of hiding. And already, I don't like this episode. None of the dialogue is coming across naturally. Nick and Dell's interaction is really stiff, and Natalie's lines don't feel right for her. It's not the acting, really, except maybe Dell. It's the dialogue itself. It feels like somebody's reading me the first draft of a screenplay. Anyway, in a car somewhere, one of the hitmen is using a scope and sees Nat and Nick talking to the girl in the caddy, and he makes a note of Nick's license plate. He'll use that information to find Nick's address later in the episode. Nick talks to Dell about children being both fragile and resilient, and Nick gets morose about not having kids. And Dell, I don't know the actor's name, but he's not good. His delivery is just stiff and not very natural sounding. Flashback. It's London. Air sirens are blaring. A young scamp enters into a manor or theater. I'm not exactly sure what the locale was supposed to be. It's mostly empty, and the boy comes across Jeanette and Nick. Nick is in a British officer's uniform. The little scamp steals Jeanette's bag, but Nick catches him, and they debate on what to do with the little ruffian. Lacroix, also in uniform, completely without humor, suggests roasting him over a fire. I love you, Lacroix. His deadpan delivery of that line added a razor's edge of darkness to an otherwise completely flat scene. Jeanette is charmed by the boy's wit, which isn't real wit. It's fake-sounding flattery, but apparently that's what the writer thinks is witty. The boy's name is Daniel, and after learning he's homeless, Jeanette suggests giving the lad a meal. Nick, of course, seems fine with it. Lacroix, less so. Back in present time, broody Nick is broody. Stonetree is telling him that Lisa, the girl, is his responsibility until her father arrives. The dad is on an oil rig, and he's usually gone for months at a time. And Lisa has no supervision? I don't get this arrangement. Anyway, Nick suggests that Natalie would be a better caretaker for her. But Stonetree wants a cop looking over here, and why not both? Why not some kind of foster arrangement with police supervision? I don't know. Anyway, Skanky is interviewing the babysitter who is watching the girl. In the interrogation room, Skanky and the babysitter, her name is DeMarco. DeMarco was supposed to be Lisa's supervision when her dad is out of town, but Lisa is a handful. And DeMarco explains that she's not really a bad kid, but not always controllable. We learned that Lisa's mother died when Lisa was a very small child, and that the mom was hit by a drunk driver when Lisa ran out into the road and her mom chased after her. Since then, Lisa feels guilty for her mother's death. Will that emotional trauma be dealt with in an appropriate way? No, not at all. Nick says he'll take protective custody of Lisa at least until her father can get to Toronto, and DeMarco is concerned about Lisa but doesn't argue with the arrangement, and we never see her again. After she leaves, Skanky teases Nick about Nick's paternal instincts being ripe for coming out. And I just want to comment that Nick is wearing a lovely purple jacket, by the way. I don't usually talk about the fashion on the show very much. I mean, frankly, if I mentioned every sort of weird early 90s outfit, that's all we would ever talk about. But Nick is rocking a Rick Astley vibe in this episode that just cannot be denied. So Nick goes to pick up Lisa, who's beguiling a room full of cops with jokes. She's supposed to be charming and witty and streetwise, but she's a weak mimeocopy of a Punky Brewster. And once again, guys, I just don't care. This episode loses me really fast, like at the cold open, and I just cannot muster any fucks to give about Punky or her fake life and terrible dialogue. And I just fucking can't with this. So, thus far, I haven't really attempted to bring any of my usual existential analysis into this episode, and I admit I am struggling with this one. Even in Dance by the Light of the Moon, which was fucking awful, I was able to connect some of the threads of that dumb story to the concept of will to power. And in episode 3, which I thought was pretty tepid, I was able to provide, through Kierkegaard, one of my favorite analyses of a scene to date on the podcast, the whole thing about the maybe both at the end of the episode. But I found pretty much nothing engaging about this episode. Even last week's episode engaged me just a bit on how horrifically problematic it was, but this one is just, it's bland. It's room temperature milk. Not curdled and bad, but not refreshing. Just bland and slightly off-putting. There is one scene coming up later in the episode that actually furthers Nick's character arc, at least in a small way. So I'm going to focus on that when it comes up. But for now, let's just slog through this. Nick drives Punky home in an unmarked car, smart enough at least not to take the Cadillac. She talks like a middle-aged TV writer writing a child, and not like an actual child. Nick realizes they're being followed, and that car pulls alongside of them. Nick orders Lisa to the floor as the passenger of the chasing car fires a shot into Nick's window, but he dodges it, at least that's what he tells Punky. And this scene should be a lot more exciting than it is, because it's not, like, at all exciting in any way. And a lot of that, again, I don't want to place a lot of blame on the actors, who I think are doing the best job they can. Even the child actors are not bad in this episode. But the dialogue is just so stupid, and it's so derivative and flat and uninteresting. And in this scene where they're being shot at, I mean, this little girl should be freaking the fuck out, and she's just, she's not. She's a cartoon character. Anyway, we cut to the lair. Nick and Punky arrive. Inexplicable Motorcycle is there, and it's official, folks. I'm having a bit of an Inexplicable Motorcycle crisis. I mean, it's still inexplicable, but by now it's so predictable, decorative even. And if we don't see Nick riding that thing before this series is over, preferably with Natalie on the back, I can't be responsible for my actions. So anyway, Punky is precocious around the lair, but in a totally unrealistic TV brat kind of way. Nick calls for Nat and asks her to come over and help. He then calls Skanky, asking him to bring over pizza. And weirdly, Skanky is hanging out watching I Dream of Jeannie. We don't see the screen of his TV, but we can hear the theme music. And he looks like an unwashed slob shoving popcorn in his face. Like, Skanky's married with a kid. Like, is his wife Mira cool with this behavior? It just smacks of cliche bachelor slobbishness. It's weird that it's Skanky, a family man. Anyway, while Nick is on the phone, Lisa discovers all his bottles in the fridge and asks if he has a drinking problem, which he just kind of waves away. Punky makes herself comfortable. She asks if Nick is married, and after taking in his digs, asks if he's straight, which did strike me as funny. Anyway, she goes on to apologize for being so much trouble, and I'm bored out of my fucking mind watching it. There's no emotional weight, there's no tension, and this kid is so fucking fake. Flashback. In the manor house, or wherever they are, Jeanette is musing over her unexpected feelings for Daniel, while Lacroix looks as bored as I feel. Nick is talking to Daniel. He finds out his parents are gone, likely dead. He says he has an aunt up north, and it's not clear if that's true or if he's just trying to get money out of them. Now, Danny here isn't that much more believable than Lisa, And again, I'll say the child actors are doing a fine job. I don't have qualms with the acting, but the dialogue is just boring and predictable. Nick and Jeanette shower the boy with attention, even giving him a present. Lacroix, though, is my spirit animal in this scene, actually growling when the boy isn't looking. Back in the present, Lisa and Nick are watching a movie. Lisa talks about Natalie and calls her Nick's girlfriend and says he should marry her. She gets morose a little bit over something that reminds her about her mom. That lasts for one hot second. Then Skanky arrives with the pizza. Now, the scene with Skanky is kind of sweet. It gives us him being charming with the girl and some follow-up on the investigation with the shooting, and I'm bored again. We cut quickly to the mobsters talking to their boss on the phone. They know the girl is holed up with a cop. To whack the cop and her ups their fee, and I guess I'm supposed to feel tension here. Oh no! Commercial break. When we come back from the break, we're still in the lair. Skanky is playing poker with Punky, who is a master card player, because of course she is. She's an emotionally damaged street girl with crushing feelings of abandonment and a desperate need for attention, which means she's spunky, witty, cute, and conniving in so fake and fucking stupid way. Nat arrives. She's maternal with Lisa and ribs Skanky a little, and... have I mentioned this episode sucks? And the same writer does next week's episode. Fuck. So, this finally brings us to the only scene in the episode I give a shit about. Nat and Nick walk off to another room. So, Nick was hit in the shoulder. And Nat is there to get the bullet out. We see Nick's reflection in a mirror as Nick digs around in the wound, and Nat mentions the wound isn't fully healed over. Now, this is important because normally Vampire Nick's wounds would heal almost immediately. That the wound is not healed means that his vampire metabolism, or whatever you call it, has changed. Nat is happy, suggesting that her program of treatments is working, and she points out the mirror. Nick says he only can see himself sometimes. And finally, this is something fucking interesting to me. It's a short scene that has nothing to do, really, with the main plot. And it's just all the more nice because the banter between Nick and Nat have great chemistry. All too soon, it's over and the mobsters have found the lair. They're outside. Back inside, Nat is digging out the bullet and Nick actually feels pain. Again, proof that he's becoming more human. So I'm going to pause here and talk about this scene, which is the only one of real substance in the episode. As I've discussed in previous episodes, namely episode 3, Natalie's treatment of Nick's condition is taken from the stance of her being a materialist, treating Nick as though his vampirism is an illness of the body, not of the spirit or the soul. Despite repeated dialogue from the vampire characters indicating their conditions to be of a soulless state. And obviously the entire point of this podcast is to interpret Nick's condition as a manifestation of an existential crisis. And so here I want to circle back around to Nat's materialism. Our condition as radically free in the Sartrean sense, which I've defined in many previous episodes, is always an embodied and situated status. Sartre and other existentialists acknowledge, some more than others, the limitations imposed on us by our bodies. Sartre and de Beauvoir began as phenomenologists, so, I mean, this isn't really a surprise. When the material realities of our embodied experiences shape the entirety of how we understand ourselves and our responsibilities as free agents, meaning that the point of existentialism, if I may be so bold to posit it, is that we remain free, totally, and as such, we are entirely responsible for our decisions and choices. The conditions of our embodied states do not absolve us of that responsibility. Back in episode 3, I said the vampire exists in a liminal space between the material and spiritual, the symbolic made manifest. In this episode, episode 13 of Forever Night, we're seeing a furthering of that idea with the evidence of Nick's transcendence towards humanness written in his body. It is a wound, a gunshot, that demonstrates his progress. As Nick makes choices and accepts responsibilities for states of being, he gets closer to actualizing his status as a radically free agent. And in so doing, his body becomes more fragile. Letting go of the identity of himself as a demonic creature of the night physically weakens him as it morally strengthens him. We can understand this existentially as a symbolic manifestation of his coming closer to rejecting the all-encompassing ego of the vampire self, indestructible with immutable desires, all ego and unchecked will to power, and closer to accepting his mortal humanity, compassion, empathy, social responsibility. This comes to him literally as a puncture, a break in the flesh, his desirous flesh made weak so that the moral self can grow. Natalie digs into his skin, causing pain. Nick looks at himself in the mirror as she does this. In a kind of mirror stage realization, he sees himself metaphorically for the first time, physical, human, hurting, wounded. The pain of the flesh, a biting reminder of pressing mortality. He says in the scene he doesn't always see himself in mirrors. This awareness is fleeting, grounded in the moment. So let's step back into the episode. We go to a flashback. Nick and Lacroix are playing chess. Lacroix notes that Jeanette wants to keep the boy, and he's kind of talking about Daniel like the boy is a puppy. Lacroix suggests bringing the boy across, and Nick balks at the idea. Back in the present time, Nick is telling Nat about Daniel. He describes Daniel as someone needing help, but that Nick was unable to. Back in the flashback, Lacroix muses how interesting it would be for Daniel to be frozen at that age he is. Nick, of course, is aghast at the idea. Lacroix suggests Jeanette's plans for the boy are not entirely maternal, and the implications there are pretty unsettling. In this scene, Nick exclaims that Daniel is too young to choose to become a vampire. And of course, Lacroix laughs this off and says that they can choose it for him. Nick is claiming, as he has throughout the series, that his life as a vampire is a status worse than death. We've heard him make sentiments to that effect repeatedly in the series. Nick feels the heavy weight of responsibility on his shoulders. He is, at least partially, responsible for interfering with this boy's life. Taking him off the street and giving him a home, even temporarily, is obviously an act of compassion. But to what end? Now Nick sees his error. And in his attempt to show compassion, he's now left with the repercussions. They can't take the child with them on their journey, so do they cast him out? Giving him a few days of love and attention just to toss him aside? Or do they take his identity and subjectivity entirely, turn him into one of them, sentence him to an endless parade of nights? Nick's unwillingness to think through the consequences of his actions lead him to this moral impasse. Perhaps better to have let the boy be, toss him a shilling and let him fend for himself in the London cityscape, rather than now face the consequences of Nick's poorly chosen compassion. Back in the present timeline, Nat and Skanky leave. Punky has fallen asleep and Nick carries her up to bed. She wakes up and tells heroic stories about her dad. Then she gets really sad about him going away and her mom being dead, and no, I don't care. I don't care about anything Punky has to say. Flashback, Nick talks to Daniel, warns him that his life is in danger. Daniel desperately doesn't want to leave, but Nick uses his vampire mind trick to make Daniel want to leave. Jeanette and LaCroix come in after Danny has left and are upset with Nick. In the present, Nick is broody. And then there's this weird interlude. What the fuck is this scene? So Nick is sitting in a chair, wearing some kind of poofy pirate shirt, and he's got just great big barrel, and he's filling bottles with liquid from this barrel. So I don't know if the barrel's supposed to be blood, if it's supposed to be wine. Natalie mentioned some sort of drink that she was making for him. Is the barrel full of that stuff? But it's completely out of nowhere. He's wearing this stupid-looking pirate shirt, and he's filling bottles, and then he's drinking from the bottle. We never see him in this outfit again in the episode, by the way. And it's just, it's weird. It's a scene that does nothing and goes nowhere, and then it's just over. We see a transition shot of the sun setting over Toronto, and then it's daytime. It's sometime later, and the mobsters pull up outside in a work van. Punky comes downstairs and finds Nick asleep on the couch. She sees a couple of bottles next to him, and she assumes that he's just a heavy drinker. Nick, by the way, is not in the poofy pirate shirt. He's back in his Rick Astley cosplay. Punky, being precocious, pours herself a drink from the bottle, but she takes a sniff of it and pours it out immediately. She tries to wake Nick up, but he doesn't rouse. She opens the blinds and let the sunlight in. She plays with a conveniently placed hand mirror and reflects sun onto Nick's face. Nick wakes up and has a major freak out and thrashes around the apartment. He cries out, "I'm blind, I'm blind," and Punky gets sad and sulks. Commercial break. By the way, Nick will be blind for about a minute and a half, and then it won't matter ever again. When we come back from the break, the workmen, slash bad guys, are using a ladder to get on the roof. In a flashback, back in the manor house, Nick discovers that LaCroix has turned young Daniel into a vampire, and this scene is creepy as fuck. So, the implications of that are really horrific. LaCroix has turned this child, an adolescent, into a fucking vampire. Has damned this boy to an eternity in this body as it is, never maturing, never realizing his full potential, never exercising his full rational will and freedom. LaCroix is fucking evil. And yes, I realize I did call him my spirit animal earlier. And you know what? I think that's the mark of a good character. That he can switch sides in my heart so quickly and yet still feel entirely consistent. In the present time, Nick realizes the danger. We cut to the police station. There, Skanky is talking to Lisa's dad and kind of laying a big guilt trip on him. Back at the lair, Nick tries to call for help, but the line has been cut. So the bad guys break in, Nick turns into a vampire, and what you think is going to happen, happens. Punky watches as Vampire Nick dispatches the bad guys and flies around the lair. And that's it. In the aftermath, Nick does a mind whammy on Punky to make her forget what she's seen and make her feel a little bit better about her life. And we go to wrap-up time. At the wrap-up, we're still in the lair, and Lisa's dad comes in, and they have a reunion. She says goodbye to everyone in characteristically quirky ways. The dad regrets being away all the time and implies that he's, you know, going to be a better father now. It's stupid, and it's cheesy, and I hate it. That's the end. We never find out what happened to Daniel, by the way. I mean, other than Nick's bodily humanity, the Daniel storyline was the only interesting thing in this episode. Did Daniel travel with Nick, Jeanette, and LaCroix? What was that dynamic like? Did Daniel rebel and run off on his own? Did he terrorize London during the war? Years later, did he ever run into a Watcher's son, pushing him towards the embrace of dark magics? Oh, wait, sorry. That's my Rupert Giles Forever Night crossover fanfic. So anyway, impressions. This episode sucks. It was boring, and I hated it. My fears that I recorded from the pre-watch were not totally founded. It's not exactly the same situation in the flashback timeline as it is in the present-day timeline. And the fact that the boy was turned into a vampire was surprisingly dark. But it just made that non-ending of that story feel like a total cop-out. There was no tension. The ending was way too cut and dried. Everything absolutely reeked of early 90s TV blandness. Ugh. So before anyone complains about my complaining, listen. I know this isn't The Wire. It's not Breaking Bad. I know not to expect hard-hitting, brutal drama. But damn it, what an opportunity to defy viewers' expectations. To take that TV scamp orphan archetype and maybe turn it around a little bit. Give the actress playing Lisa, who, like I said, wasn't a bad actress, give her something to do besides being fakish and cute. Give us an indication of her real issues and emotional baggage, and then lay that at the feet of Nick, a person who has destroyed lives, destroyed families. Let him see the aftermath of a broken family, a child in mourning, reaching out for help to mend their broken heart, only to find police, mobsters, and cold hard violence. My dislike for this episode may ruffle feathers of other Forever Night fans. I've read lots of positive posts about this episode's, mainly citing the acting between Nick and Punky as being very genuine, and I don't disagree. As I hope I've made very clear, all the actors are doing the best they can. Our main actors give their all and at their top of their game. I actually like Skanky's interaction with Lisa the most. The children playing Daniel and Lisa are great, given what they had to work with. No, I'm laying the blame squarely on the shoulders of the writers. The dialogue was bland, and it was stupid. The story lacked any emotional resonance. There was just nothing to it. And I really want to know what the fuck happened to Daniel. So anyway, guys, where does this leave us for next week? I mentioned the writer for next week's episode is the same as this week's writer, so I'm really hoping that's not a bad omen. Next week is episode 14 of season 1, entitled Spin Doctor, which I think is the one where Nick is accused of being a communist. Stay tuned, gentle listener, for Still Dreaming, an existentialist journey through our forever night. Do you want to connect with Still Dreaming? You can find us on Instagram at Still Dreaming Podcast and on Twitter at podcast_still. And we have a group on Facebook. Just look up Still Dreaming Podcast. Would you like to help support the show? Donation buttons can be found on our website, stilldreamingpodcast.wordpress.com. Let's pause for a word from our sponsor. Still Dreaming is a podcast hosted and recorded by me,
in the newly revamped CERK Internet Radio Studio. Forever Night was produced for CBS by Glenn Warren Productions and Sony Pictures Television. All rights reserved.